I'm Christian Scheller. Welcome to my podcast, an enthusiastic ramble through whatever has taken my interest the past week or so. Expect technology, games, history, travel, geekery, and as always, much, much more. Welcome to another Chinchilla Squeaks with me, Christian Scheller, back after a little bit of a holiday. I was in Boston. I spent most of my time in Cambridge, actually, Harvard and MIT area. Very nice area, actually. And Harvard was very pretty. MIT gave me this kind of feeling of awe, actually. You know, probably the same at Stanford, just one of these places where you know so many things have been invented and discovered and et cetera, et cetera. It didn't look as pretty as Harvard, but it had more impact on me. And I felt slightly nerdy and nervous. But enough of that. I am back with another interview with Loris of Sysdig. Sysdig are another company in the cloud container asset infrastructure security and observability ecosystem, but have actually been around it for some time. So bring a different perspective to what has increasingly become a busy space, but they have been there since the very early days. So we talk about all sorts of things around their journey and the journey of that ecosystem. But first, I am going to start with a few links. I've got quite a few from Wired for some reason today. I think I resubscribed to the newsletter, so that might be why. But hey, it's good to know that Wired is still ticking along, putting out good quality content anyway. And this is something from Carrie McCannon about the GitHub black market that helps coders cheat the popularity contest. This actually relates very nicely. It's a shame it didn't come out 2 weeks ago, back to my interview with Donna on the last episode from the Chaos Project about metrics and how GitHub metrics are not particularly reliable, or to be precise, GitHub vanity metrics like forks and pull requests and likes and stars and things like that. This is gamed way more than you might think. There's literally a website called buygithub.com where people, I don't know who would do this, but I guess people do, can pay mostly crypto tokens, unsurprisingly, to get stars on projects. And $6 can get you 50. I find it hard to know if that's worth it. $6 seems kind of high for 50 stars. And how do they do it? Is it with people or is it automated? I'm not sure, but this whole and it's part of a whole wider black market of online engagement. She also mentions upvotes on Product Hunt, followers and views on Kaggle, and all sorts of things. And I think where this really relates is that for years, many people, including myself, have been telling people, you know, you need to have a community profile, an open source profile, that kind of thing. And as everybody does that, how do you stand out? Well, you have to have a better looking profile. So is it worth you paying to have a better looking profile? And if everybody now has a better looking profile, what's next, et cetera, et cetera. I've heard many people saying that now these online profiles that used to differentiate you from everybody else also are not enough anymore. So what is next, I suppose, is the conversation. And this article really digs into how bad it's actually become. One, it mentions here, cryptocurrency, it seems to be unfortunate. OKCash, OKCash, I don't know, it was the worst offender. 97% of its 759 stars, which actually isn't a tremendous amount, were flagged as fake. And then Apache Airflow, a much better established project, 1.6% of 29,435 stars. So there seems to be a little bit of a sweet number, maybe. When it's very low or very high, maybe it's more reliable. When it's in the middle, that's where it's hard to tell. But I found it interesting. GitHub are kind of aware of this, the presence of these problems, and are actively working to remove them. So I guess it's relatively obvious that people are doing this, maybe. I still don't see the benefit, seeing as I'm not sure how many people even really pay attention to GitHub stars anymore. But there you go. Don't trust everything you see, even if you already weren't. Well, there's even more reason not to, I suppose. On the subject of things you read on the internet that maybe you shouldn't trust, this is an article from Mark Hirschberg over on his Medium called Prompt Engineering Jobs Are a Mirage. We were all promised that the very many jobs that are potentially being replaced by the new generative artificial intelligence, we could all get prompt engineering jobs. And apparently that's not really true. There aren't actually that many prompt engineering jobs. There are jobs that involve prompt engineering or prompt engineering editing, as it seems to be these days, increasingly more so. But actual prompt engineering jobs, do they exist? He couldn't find very many, actually. He looked in late September, Upwork had 3 jobs. And if you took away location, 8 jobs. LinkedIn had 13 in the US. He specifically says he put prompt engineer as a title and then reiterates what I just said. There are plenty of software engineering jobs that include those words. And then there's a website called Prompt Jobs, has a total of 82 jobs. And most of them seem to be from a long time ago, maybe just cashing in on hype, a little bit like the last article. So what aspects of all the new jobs that AI might bring are hype? I suppose that remains to be seen. But so far, prompt engineering does not seem to be something that companies are jumping on board to employ. What that says about everything else is hard to say exactly, but interesting to see that quite what that will mean moving forward remains to be seen, of course. Revisiting artificial intelligence again, this was sort of reasonably widely reported, but I am quoting here from MIT Technology Review with Melissa Heikler and also from The Verge, from Amelia David, talking about Nightshade, a new project that is promising to give creators a power to basically poison, corrupt information that AI models may be scraping. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the concept of robots.txt, where you can block SEO and website crawlers from scraping your website. And people have been wondering if there's a similar thing you could do with various LLM, language model scraping tools. And I did see something on Mastodon that was showing you how that could work. But here is another far more combative way where you actually literally throw in it's a little bit confusing as to exactly how it works. A lot of people talked about it, but it wasn't clear to me how it works exactly. But it a way for creators to fight back against companies using your work, and you use it to poison the training data. So they would think dogs are cats, cars become cows, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know if it's actually usable yet. It's something that is in peer review, so maybe it's not even usable yet. I'm not 100% sure. But none of these articles really completely describe how it works. Are you actually poisoning the like an image or the text or something like that? Or are you adding something on top? The people behind it have actually created similar-ish tools. For this, they made Glaze, a tool that allows artists to mask their personal style. Yeah, and it worked in a similar way to the way Nightshade is purported to work by changing the pixels of images in subtle ways that are invisible to the human eye, but manipulate machine learning models. Now, this is interesting because this reminds me of some things I studied at school, at university, actually, where we looked at creating image filters for tools like Photoshop, et cetera, et cetera. And something that was really mind-blowing there to me was that when you start breaking down the composition of images, which are just patterns of pixels for edge detection, you know, you look for patterns, big differences between patterns of numbers, for example. And when you start to realize that all images are just numerical values, you could start to see how this something like this could work. But I wonder if it's so small that a lot of the scraping services will find a way around it very, very quickly. That's always the problem with doing your work out in the open. I suppose it remains to be seen if anyone has any success with this outside of the academic circles it's being trialed in. But I'd be interested to try it, I suppose, and how much you can make it a part of your workflow. Can you bake it into Photoshop? Can you bake it into other image manipulation tools, that kind of thing? You know, is the process of using it too technical, too complex for many creatives? And if it's just images, great. What about text and all sorts of other things? It's harder to add in noise to text that doesn't distract the intended audience as well. So, you know, it's not a one-size-fits-all option right now. Now, coming back sort of full circle from the present to the past, this is something I really liked also on The Verge from Amanda Chicago Lewis, talking about the people who ruined the internet. And this is her attending an event in Florida, along with an alligator, not hers, at the actual event, of people involved in search engine optimization. And, you know, people basically blame them for ruining the internet in the first place. The interesting thing I found with this was how many of them had been involved in the industry for so long, and also how many of them are not really experiencing as lucrative work as they used to either. But for the ones that have been involved in it for a while, they sort of have made enough already that they don't care. Versus those probably thinking about getting into SEO right now that may not be viable anymore. But in the past, it was more viable and was quite lucrative, in fact. And now I wonder, with these constantly moving goalposts, how these people really keep up with it and how they really continue to command the sorts of fees and status reported in the articles that they used to be able to do. And it seems that these days that a lot of them are just giving basic advice rather than kind of doing the sort of black magic that people think they always used to do. And they definitely even themselves say that now their work has become less useful and less valuable and harder for them with this proliferation of just, I mean, in the future, machine generated, but at the moment, just human machine generated crap that pollutes content on the internet. Nobody doing the right thing at any scale could really compete with someone just abusing a system, I suppose, is the argument there. So, I mean, no matter what you think of them, spare a thought for them, because they're suffering from the same problems many of us are now. And of course, in the SEO world, there were people who were trying to do good things as well, you know, get the search results for well-meaning companies and projects surfaced, not just yet another kind of clickbait article, maybe. I don't know if people necessarily differentiated from that. But I found it interesting because it really reminded me of when I first started on the internet myself and what the world used to be like and how it used to be kind of so much simpler. And then in the past 10 years or so, changes from Microsoft and Google have really thrown a spanner in the works of how we all used to think we could get content discovered. And now no one's really sure anymore, in all honesty. And the advice you get, especially from Google, who still remain the most important player, of course, is not very clear. They kind of direct you to resources that are very vague. And there's a lot of actual discussion in the article about the writer speaks to some people who work at Google, especially, who say, oh, we have lots of documentation. We have more than ever. But none of that documentation ever really goes into the specifics about what you're actually supposed to do. And I guess the reason is that Google knows as well that if they did, then if everybody knows how to, if game a system is right, but then no, it doesn't really solve the problem. I don't know, but it's a challenge for everybody in some respects, because if the rules aren't clear, then how do people play the game? But some people can play the game better than others, so there obviously are rules that they've figured out how to game, if that makes sense. I'm not sure if that makes sense at all. But anyway, I found it very interesting just to see the pain and the effort that people we easily criticize have to go through now to do their work too. And many of them were trying to help us. And many of us do similar things on a smaller scale to try and get our work noticed. And does it matter anymore, I suppose, is the question to ask, whoever you are. So, yeah, have a read. At the very least, just hear about the alligator that was just wandering around the event. It is Florida, after all. Wrapping up with two articles, both from Wired. I told you there was a lot of interesting articles on Wired around advertising effectively. YouTube is cracking down on ad blockers. I actually do use an ad blocker. I don't think I ever noticed it blocking ads on YouTube. I'm not 100% sure. And it has caused a lot of people to uninstall ad blockers because they're basically saying if you're using an ad blocker, you will be blocked from using YouTube. I don't exactly know how they can enforce that, but maybe they've got ways of sniffing identities of browsers and things like that. It kind of worries you in some way because how private do you have to be for them to not be able to figure out that you're the same person using a browser in different ways? That kind of thing is concerning in itself. And it's interesting because I'm obviously a person who benefits from ad-supported media, and there's always this increasing issue now where I don't like ad-supported media myself, but I benefit from it. Where do I stand on this? Advertising has gone too far. The last topic I just covered sort of is a summary of that as well, and it's probably going to get worse. And what's the alternative? Everybody asking you to pay the price of a coffee each month to get free content without advertising? That's also not sustainable. So it's really a problem at the moment of knowing exactly how to get people to pay for content, and sort of forcing people into it also isn't really a good way either. Or is it? To be honest with you, I don't know, because I would like to get paid for the videos I make. Do I think that YouTube doing this is a good idea? I don't really know myself. I'd love to hear from you, actually. How would you like to pay for content? And how much do you think getting people to pay for content should be, a carrot versus a stick? Head on over to christianjiller.com, where you can see on the front page my contact details, because I would really like to hear from you. And you can also post comments if you're on the newsletter version on the Substack post as well. And finally, in this avenue, Facebook has finally put a price on privacy, mostly forced out by EU regulation. Meta is about to roll out an ad-free subscription on Instagram and Facebook. $10 a month. It doesn't seem terrible. And this is just in Europe. I've been thinking about ideas around this space for some time, actually, and when this would happen. And I was never really sure what it would be. $10 doesn't seem terrible in some respects. I sort of wonder how much it will affect people using it. And then equally how it will affect your usage of Meta services. Them having no tracking, does that mean the content will get worse or better for you? It's very hard to know. They've been an interesting experiment to see, actually. So if you are in the European Union, Norway, Iceland, Liechtenstein, or Switzerland at some point in November, and you get offered, have a look, sign up, see what happens. It would be interesting to see. Maybe I should try it myself for a couple of months to see how it improves or ruins my Meta experience. And that was my articles for the week. Let's jump in with an interview with Loris of Sysgeek. Today I'm joined by Loris. Loris Didjuan.
That looks great.
Okay, sounds close enough. My name is much easier most of the time. From Sysgeek, security tools for containers, Kubernetes, and cloud. This is definitely a topic that has been a big subject at KubeCon the past couple of years, maybe. But Sysgeek's been around a little bit longer than I think than some of the current wave of container security tools. So let's maybe start with a little bit of Sysgeek's origin story and how you got to today.
Yeah, we have been around. Sysgeek is definitely one of the companies that sort of, you know, the precursors of security and visibility in the cloud space, and in particular with Kubernetes. The company at this point is almost 10 years old. Oh. And I started the company with a background in open source. and in particular in open source packet capture. So my prior company was called Case Technologies, and I ran it between 2005 and 2010. And it was the company behind a pretty well-known open source network analyzer called Wireshark.
Oh, yeah.
Wireshark is used by pretty much anybody that has anything to do with network packets. And Wireshark, and in particular, you know, the packet capture components of Wireshark, where I have a long history with that because I started working on those while I was a student in Italy, in my university in Italy. And then Wireshark, we pick up the packet capture library built, and Wireshark became extremely popular. We built a company around that, and we were acquired in 2010. I went to work for the company who acquired us, and I quickly realized that, I mean, we were doing packets and packet capture and visibility and security by using essentially the, you know, like the spam port of the router and the communications on the network as the source of truth. During those years, we used to say packets never lie. But the world was changing, and actually packets were starting lying a little bit, because cloud was starting to explode. You know, AWS was becoming a thing. We were talking about 2010, 2011. And in the cloud, you're renting instances, but you don't have the physical network anymore where you can tap, you know, to collect your information. And then, you know, a little past company called .cloud was renamed into Docker, and the container revolution was starting. And there are people that are packing hundreds of containers in a single machine. And if you're sitting, you know, on a router or tapping into the network wire, you are missing a lot at that point, you know, because there's this density of entities that are communicating very often without leaving a trace on the network. And originally the impetus behind Sysdig was, okay, the world is changing, a new stack is being defined. This stack is extremely powerful. It has to do with cloud, with microservices, with containers, and so on. How do we make sure that we, as a community, as an open source community initially, we offer the same level of visibility that was available in the legacy data center? And that's how Sysdig started, essentially.
Can I just, like, my timelines around the increasing popularity of containers around Docker basically was about 2014, 15, I guess?
Yeah, 2013 is when Docker essentially became a thing. Okay. Kubernetes, I think the first release was 2014, later, if I remember well, something like that. And then KubeCons started becoming really popular in 2015, 2016. Yeah.
So was Sysdig there at day zero, or did Sysdig do something else before?
No, pretty much we started the company around the same time, recognizing, I mean, at that point, it was an absolute gamble, because it was really, really the early days. We essentially participated to the very early days, and it was fun, because you really had to define what a security stack would be, what data collection would be, what a monitoring stack would be for these architectures, you know? So as the broader Kubernetes community was operating and iterating on Kubernetes and the other components like Prometheus and so on very quickly, we were participating by trying to define what does it mean, you know? What does it even mean to secure these entities? What is the relationship with the cloud? How do you interface these, you know, with other cloud services? How do you use labels for, how do you do your low level instrumentation and all of these kind of problems that now, you know, there's sort of a standard to solve these problems, but we had to invent it from a blank sheet of paper.
So let's actually dig into a little bit before we go into the products that Sysdig has, and especially some of the open source groups as well. Let's actually maybe dig into a little bit of what security means in the container space. You've talked about something like Wireshark, which is looking at packets, but that's not the end of it, is it, in containers these days? There's a wider security discussion with things like software security, supply chain, et cetera, that isn't just about packets, kind of as you said. So what's the big picture around security in containers?
All right, so the big picture. As I was saying about packets, we quickly realized that, it's stuff that is still important, understanding what's happening on the network, but largely, especially for like the purposes of runtime security, they were not the right data source. I would say when we look at modern infrastructures, I would say the areas that are architecturally extremely relevant, including for security, are number one, the fact that we're relying more and more on automated pipelines to build our software, that's so-called, you know, CI/CD. And number two is the increased decomposition of the software that we run into services and the automatic orchestration of these services. Architectural trend number one, the one of CI/CD, has created a lot of opportunities to bolt security earlier in the process of creating software and tying more the security team and the security features into what developers do. Right, so the so-called shiftless security, where we go into the ability to scan images, to do supply chain, to go even maybe further left into code. Infrastructure is called security, in fact, because you know our infrastructures are more and more universally defined as pieces of code declared in one of a handful of languages that you can use, CloudFormation, Terraform, and so on. They are put in a Git repository, so security tools like, for example, SysD can go to this Git repository and scan these infrastructure definitions for compliance, for privileges, for all of this kind of stuff. And, you know, security, the shifts maybe even left going like into code as this code is built and being able to block the release or even building, you know, pieces of code depending on their security profile and so on. So security more and more becomes an integral part of the CI/CD pipeline and becomes, you know, it's possible to bridge essentially, you know, security with traditional development. Microservices, on the other hand, the big result is decomposition of software into small pieces that talk through APIs. And the fact that these different components of the software are more and more, you know, orchestrated and automated. This creates fantastic operational advantages, but also has two implications. One is that things are moving very, very quickly. And so, you know, when security in the past was maybe a matter of days, now it's a matter of minutes, very often seconds, you know. Containers can really go up and down very quickly. The other implication is there's a lot of little modules. So, you know, we don't have a monolith anymore. We don't have pets anymore. We have not even kettles. We have locusts, you know. They're so small and they move so quickly. So how do you even just understand what they're doing is a problem that is not completely trivial to solve.
Yeah. I'm really interested to know how, like, we've kind of gone back over it a little bit again, but so, for example, you know, your most popular open source project these days is Falco, which is, mm-hmm. I mean, as far as I'm aware, is largely, I just want to double check, because I've looked at it from a very particular perspective.
Falco is your security camera for modern cloud-based container-based infrastructures.
Yeah.
You deploy it on the nodes, but it's actually being able to see inside containers. That's one of the things that SysDig innovated
in the early days. Yeah.
And Falco collects all of the signals that are based on system calls as a bunch of community curated policies and rules, and is able to tell you, hey, on this container, somebody has just executed, you know, a shell and is trying to run commands.
Right. Okay.
Or somebody's just modified a binary file in the Redis container. Or, I mean, there's tens and tens and tens of these rules, you know?
I think that's kind of where I was interested, because I've only experimented with it from the kind of the software bill of materials perspective, which mm-hmm. I'm guessing mm-hmm. is probably a more recent addition. And that's mm-hmm. where I was kind of wondering, what was Falco doing before, if it's been around so long? And so it was actually doing something much more interesting, which I guess leads into the whole Sysdig Secure, Sysdig Monitor platform you have.
Exactly. Falco is the core of our runtime security products, essentially. Yeah. And it's something that can efficiently sit everywhere in your infrastructure, receive multiple signals, process them very quickly at the edge, generate insights that are then collected in a central place to generate, to create, you know, indicators of attack and indicators of compromise.
It's actually interesting because that starts to really show the Wireshark heritage there.
Very much so. So now you see why I started talking about, you know, pre-Sysdig and talking about Wireshark, because very much, you know, nothing is ever invented from scratch, right? So the inspiration, the original inspiration at Sysdig, especially with the open source that we do at Sysdig, is, okay, you know, packets are challenging, but what can we use essentially to get something that is similar in terms of properties? And we created originally a system, a set of tools that are able to collect system calls from running cloud infrastructure. System calls are every call that a process running inside a container or inside a physical host or inside a virtual machine does to the operating system.
Yeah.
So opening or closing a file is a system call. Creating, deleting files, of course, reading and writing, establishing network connections, inter-process communications, executing commands, running processes. All of this stuff is system calls. And the beauty of system calls is that we're able to sit in the operating system, in the kernel of the operating system, and then every container for us is we are able to see inside, essentially, because every container generates system calls that go through the operating system. So the collection nowadays done through a facility called EBPF in the kernel of the operating system.
Yeah, I was starting to wonder that if that's what Falco was using.
Very much so. And and it becomes similar to the old spam port of the router. You know, instead of sitting on the router and looking at the packets that go through the network, we sit inside the operating system and we look at the system calls. And this is a model that works very well. If you look at security, especially the ability to collect information for the applications that are running in modern cloud infrastructures, especially in containers. Originally, everybody that was offering solutions was saying, well, containers are like mini hosts, so let's treat them like hosts and let's install something, a daemon or a library inside each of the containers. That didn't scale at all. Wave number two was, okay, you know, Kubernetes introduced the concept of sidecar for a pod. So if we need to do security, if we need to do monitoring, if we need to do log collection, we can put a sidecar inside the pod and we can collect the data that way. That didn't work as well because you still have, you know, you have all for all of your containers that are now you need to run inside the same pod another six other containers just for data collection. So the Sysdig model was forget about that. You sit underneath, you sit in the kernel of the operating system, and you're able to see all of these signals. At that point, you only have one point of instrumentation, and you can run 500 containers in a machine. You still collect the stuff only in one single place, and you have only one Falco per machine. And that's what Falco brought to the community, essentially, to the industry, a vision on how to do essential instrumentation for very verbose infrastructures made of microservices that are made of little containers in a way that doesn't require you to deploy 5 million things everywhere, because you can sit in the kernel and you have a daemon set in Kubernetes, and that's the only thing that you need to do.
What, I mean, EBPF as a more adopted standard is relatively new. So was Falco using something else before? Or was it a trailblazer there as well?
The first incarnation of instrumentation for Falco and also for commercial Sysdig was kernel modules. Okay. It was still an open source approach, but it was based on essentially extending the kernel through kernel modules, like similar to a device driver.
Yeah.
EBPF brought a beautiful innovation there by allowing people to execute stuff in the operating system kernel in a way that is based on a virtual machine. So it's safe and validated. So the beauty of eBPF compared to using kernel modules is that you're not running arbitrary C code in the kernel of your operating system, but you're running a virtual machine that is sandboxed, validated, verified, and so on. So as soon as eBPF was available, we immediately embraced it in 2017-2018, and we created, by the time, something that was radically complex as a BPF script, you know? At the time, eBPF was used to run 10 line of code scripts in the kernel of the operating system. We created a collection system that was 10,000 lines of code, and everybody thought we were crazy. And still now, you know, the Falco eBPF module is one of the most sophisticated pieces of eBPF, but we proved that eBPF could be used for this kind of production grade, sophisticated, advanced use cases.
It's also strange because there's a lot of other companies and projects that talk about eBPF a lot, and you don't mention it very much at all, which is kind of interesting. An interesting approach, maybe, but
it's always a debate. I mean, personally, so a couple of things. One is I talked about this at a conference few months ago. There's a little bit of fed about eBPF, there's now the tendency from industry players to create the equivalence eBPF equal perfect instrumentation. You know, my product is based on eBPF, and therefore I am modern and I am perfect. As I was mentioning, eBPF is a virtual machine. It's like Java or .NET, you know, or something like that. So, you know, it's almost like saying I write Java software and therefore my software is perfect. This is just what runs your programs, you know, and then you still need to write something useful and something that does its job and hopefully does it well, you know. So I've always been a little bit skeptical, probably because we got into this kind of stuff so early, about companies that just make a flag out of this, you know, because and I very much prefer, even with Falco, to talk about the merits, what it does and how it does and why it's useful, rather than the tools that it uses, you know, because that's not the final goal.
No,
sorry about the rant.
Oh, no, it's just totally fine, you know. I've had other eBPF people on the other side, so.
Don't take me wrong. By the way, I've been involved with eBPF.
No, I can see that.
With eBPF when it was still called BPF. eBPF stands for Enhanced Packet Path Filter.
Yes,
I was working on BPF and I wrote the first just-in-time compiler for BPF in 2000.
Just like containers, eh? Nothing new, actually.
So 20 plus years ago, you know. So I love the technology still being one of my
oh, for sure.
I mean, if you did passions, but it's a technology, you know?
Yeah, no, for sure. Okay. So moving into a little bit of Sysdig's platform as a whole, I just wanted to touch on one of the other open source kind of standards that you adhere to, which is much more recent and really starts to bring the security into the enterprise world, but also into the regulatory world. And this is the kind of whole policy idea. And so in your case, it's, now I want to double check, OPA, I'm assuming it's
Open Policy Agent.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I just want to double check because it's not on your webpage. So I just want to double check what it actually stood for. So the Open Policy Agent, and this in theory allows people to say, you know, for our images, for our containers, there are going to be these licenses, there has to be this certain level of vulnerabilities, there has to be X, Y, Z, and anything that's in violation of that can't run, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, personally, I actually feel like, I don't know who's going to be first, the European Union or somebody else, but that something like the whole software bill of materials and the kind of work around policy around infrastructure as code is going to be regulated fairly soon-ish. In government terms anyway. So the fact that this is now moving into something companies can offer to businesses is definitely it's definitely a selling point that is going to be more important in the next few years. And you're using that, and I think this leads into, I feel like, because you've generated your own an acronym here, CNAP, the Cloud Native Application Protection Platform. And I'm guessing this leverages a lot of these components we've been talking about into that window, that viewpoint for businesses and business owners to see what is happening, basically.
Yeah, and CNAP, I want to clarify, is not a SysDig acronym. It's okay. More like an industry-wide. It's actually Gartner, you know, like okay. the analyst company that has created this acronym to define essentially, you know, what a platform, a modern platform for cloud security looks like. And one thing about cloud security is, well, cloud is cool and powerful, but also complex. And so cloud security as well tends to be a complex, multifaceted area. And with the acronym CNAP, Gartner is sort of defining a little bit what a tool, a solution that offers this kind of security looks like, and what kind of features are required there, and also help the users essentially orient themselves in understanding and figuring out what are the big areas, the big blocks that need to be covered when securing a modern cloud infrastructure. And this, of course, includes several areas. It includes vulnerability management and the ability to understand if your software, your components, your infrastructure are secure. Includes compliance and the ability to validate that your software and your infrastructure, when it runs, it adheres to specific policies. And as you were mentioning, this is important not only for the actual security of your software, but because it's in a global environment, it's very important to ensure that the software that you bring to your users respects the different policy and government's mandates of the different countries and continents. But another important, very important area of cloud security and of a CNAP platform is the so-called runtime security, because you can be as careful and as disciplined as you want in detecting your vulnerabilities early on and applying your policies and automate, and blocking software that, as you were mentioning before, that doesn't meet specific policies. But then in the end, your software is running in adverse environments with attackers coming from all over the world. So the ability to detect threats at runtime, both on the workload side, so your containers and instances and virtual machines and so on, and on the cloud side, is a very important requisite. From the CNAP point of view, what the unique perspective that SysDig brings is bringing the different souls of a CNAP platform, so like the vulnerability management, the compliance one, and the runtime one, together and tying them in a way that puts runtime as the centerpiece and makes everything better by using signals that are coming from runtime. What do I mean? I mean that very often, you scan your software for vulnerabilities and you find that your software has maybe hundreds of vulnerabilities, and maybe you tell your developers, or you even prevent your developers from releasing their software because it has so many vulnerabilities. But are they actually used? Are they actually loaded in memory? Are they part of a software that is executed? Is this software in a critical environment, or is it just in a hidden test environment or build environment that doesn't really matter? These are all important questions that if you're able to answer, you can make life so much better for everybody, and you can make software much more secure because you allow the teams to prioritize on what's really important. This is the perspective on a CNAP platform.
It's actually really interesting, because I've definitely spoken to companies on the two sides of what you offer, the container security scanning and the observability, the runtime. But you're actually offering both and making those more of those connections. There's a couple of companies that do it in their own way, but that offering those connections between the two and filtering out a lot of the things that may not be necessary. I really like what you say about that. There may be dependencies that are part of a build chain that it doesn't actually matter if it's out of date or whatever, because no one outside of the internal team is really using it anyway. I mean, one could argue that that is still a potential vulnerability, but yeah, you it gives you a bit more insight into the actual state of things, not just, oh, big red list of problems with no real context.
Yeah. Exactly. And these companies that you mentioned, you know, are relatively new to this. Well, Sysdig has been working on this for years now, you know. And a little bit, like we was talking about defining the Kubernetes security stack, this is another thing that we define for the industry. And of course, we're moving very fast. So, for example, we do this now, like, for user entitlement and privileges, you know. And so we're able to look at users that are running in the cloud and what are they doing and what privileges do they actually need to do what they're doing? And they were able to reconcile this with how have they been configured, you know? And we've discovered, for example, that like 95% of the privileges that are given to cloud users, that users that operate on cloud infrastructures, are not used, you know. So we're able to close the loop and tell our customers, okay, you know, this user needs only like 1% of what's been granted, and you can make it this much more airtight by reducing. So there's many ways we're looking at what thing looks like at runtime, and they were able to feed it back to configuration and to being able to remove gaps and security issues by doing that.
And just finally, I'd like to touch on the future. So I see you do have this Sysdig Sage, which I got excited for a second and wondering if it was you looking at like generative AI models that were running in containers and telling people the sources of things. But no, it's the other approach. But it's actually interesting in itself. You know, we talked about people having access to all this information, but what does it really mean to them? And the ability to literally talk to that data set to find out the answers in a more conversational way. How have you found, have people been using it, or is it still very in early stages? Or
we are in early stages. By the way, Sage is a little bit my baby, you know, and it's essentially the being able to merge a ChatGPT like modern large language model with the ultra rich and multi-domain data set that is at the core of a platform like Sysdig and Sysdig Secure. And there are some things in cloud security, for example, cloud security, based on what I told you, is inherently multi-domain, right? So there are some really interesting challenges in like, how do we actually make an LLM effectively operate in such a complex domain and make it possible for an LLM to jump from one domain to the other domain and then come back and actually help find the needle in the haystack.
Yeah.
So Sage is designed to be as close as possible to a human assistant that has deep expertise in cloud security and can give superpowers to our users, because it knows our product very well. It knows the field extremely well. And it's able to sift through all of this data together with the user and find something that maybe the user wouldn't find, or if it would find take a lot of time, and then just help the user iterate on these and really understand quickly what's happening and judge if what's happening is okay, bad, or good, you know?
Then finally, if you have just a couple more minutes, you and Sysdig have been in the space for longer than many in the space. What's next? What is next for the company? What is next for the industry, do you think, that you will keep on top of?
I think that the industry is clearly at a time where, you know, like there's a clarification on what exactly means to do cloud security and sort of a convergence of different features, right? So Sysdig comes a little bit more from the runtime / container point of view, but we have very quickly increased the functionality in our platform to cover very well all of the areas that have to do with like cloud security and posture management and vulnerability management everything that is more like a cloud. And the thing that, as I was mentioning before with our news, so the ability to understand what's used at runtime, the future for this industry is going from a bunch of vertical solutions that are packaged together into a platform to something that is really cohesive, coherent, and being able to offer a powerful experience to the user that really allows the users to operate in this complex multi-domain world. And this is why, for example, I'm so excited about LLMs, because I think that they are part on this equation, and they're part of being able to tie things together, prioritize better, and respond faster to threats in an environment that by definition puts multiple domains together.
Fantastic. Great to have you. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you for having me. It was a great pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Loris from Sysgig. I did too. And I've got plenty more in the can to get out over the next few months. So I hope you enjoy those interviews. If you do enjoy those interviews, please head on over to wherever you are listening and give me a review. Just even some stars would be great, but a comment would be even better. That would be very, very helpful right now as I try to build the show up a bit more. I don't have a ton to update you on because I have been away. I'm working on NaNoWriMo this month again, National Novel Writing Month for 2023. I'm pretty much well in progress there. I'm also working on some game competitions and some other nonfiction books. So I'm working on lots of big projects right now, hence I don't have too many small ones. And I'll be at Web Summit in Lisbon next week if you happen to be there and would like to have an interview or a conversation. So there won't be too much more in between now and the next episode either because of that. So I'm just going to wrap up and thank you very much for joining me, and take care, everybody. I hope you enjoyed the show. Find out more about me at chrischinchilla.com, where you can find show notes, sign up for my newsletter, and find all of my writing, games, work, and video links. There's also details on how to get in touch with me. And if you want to get even closer to what I do, join my Discord server for behind-the-scenes discussions and helping me produce my shows and work.